SBS live streams and podcasts are supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Queensland University Press has just added new publications to their First Nations Classics, a series that recognises the legacy of Indigenous voices that shaped Australia's literary landscape. And I'm pleased to say I'm joined by award-winning author and academic Michaela Saunders, whose role is instrumental in this series. Thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Thank you, Bertrand.
Now, today we'll be talking about your book, Always Will Be. But before we delve into that book, I'd like you to talk about another book that's also featured in this series, a book that you introduced, Plains of Promise by Alexis Wright. I read the introduction and one of the sentences that really caught my eye is one where you talk about being the only daughter of, you know, it's several generations of only daughters, and this is a poignant story of stolen generations. Yeah, tell us about this book and the story behind it.
Plains of Promise was published in 1997. That's the year that I was in year seven, so I was becoming, you know, a young teenager. I didn't read the book at the time, but in my introduction I talk about how 1997 is a really significant year for this book to be published in. We had the Bringing Them Home report tabled in Parliament. It was a landmark document, and the process of research that went into that was people were interviewing stolen generations people about their experiences, and you know, they were taking this testimony, and they were, for the first time, there was a widespread recognition of what the stolen generations went through and what they were still going through to that day. So into this cultural moment, this was published, and of course the story deals with several generations of women who were removed and moved around and disconnected from culture and returning to culture. So that's all really significant. Now, on a personal level, around that time is when my mother and her brother, my uncle, reconnected with their grandmother because they never met. They were like in their 40s at the time, and they had never met because of these processes of removals. And so this book and this moment is very important for people like myself and other descendants of stolen people and stolen people themselves, because it shows us, in fictional form of course, but it gives us a map to understand what we go through and why we feel the way we do about certain things, and how these policies have these transgenerational effects that still affect us to this day.
And that was in literature. I was just following in the news today that some of the First Nations films that were released about stolen generations were actually not very well received, because mainstream Australia could not recognize the veracity of the stories told in those films. And in literature, was timely to actually be telling those stories, because no one would know about what happened.
It's pretty unbelievable stuff if you don't know, but this is why people say that Australia has a black history, that Australia, you know, has all these kind of skeletons in its closet that it refuses to acknowledge. Now, at the time that I was talking about, in those, you know, mid to late 90s, this was all very new information for the average Australian. They just didn't want to believe it. I think now, some decades later, there's more of a widespread acceptance and understanding of what happened, but that's really because of books like Plains of Promise, the Bringing Them Home report, and the tireless advocacy and activism of our people in pushing these stories to the forefront and getting people to accept that this is really what happened, and this is how our people have been affected by these policies. Because you wouldn't want to believe it. It's really horrible stuff, but this is in fact what our old people went through, and what a lot of people are still going through today.
Well, it's feared there's actually another form of stolen generations happening silently, but this needs to be addressed.
That's right, yeah. So while the policies, you know, ostensibly change, the removals kept going on. And in fact, there are more children out of home care today than there were at the height of stolen generations, you know. sadly, you know, young people in my own family are in state care too. So these are the kinds of things that we're still, when I say that we're still being affected, I'm saying that, you know, these things didn't happen in the past. They're still happening to us. And there are better solutions, and our people have always had the solutions, and they've put these solutions forward. And a lot of these solutions are recommended in the Bringing Them Home report. But as we know, many Australian governments don't like to look at these recommendations because they think they're the experts on our problems. But our people are. And, you know, one of those recommendations is that instead of taking children and putting them into other places, removing them from their country and culture, not just their family, but their country and their culture and the community, to keep them with family as much as possible. And we do see that happening, but it's not enough. You know, there's still a lot of work to be done.
Now, this theme of child removals and Australian generation is the theme I've covered in another review that will be published in the next few days in the context of NAIDOC Week. So covering these themes couldn't be more timely. Now, coming back to your book, Always Will Be is the winner of the, is an award-winning book in its own right, winner of the 2022 David Unaipon Award. It's also described as an outstanding and timely collection of speculative fiction, imagining futures where Indigenous sovereignty is fully reasserted. Now, what inspired you to tell this story in the form of a speculative fiction narrative?
Well, I've always been a fan of speculative fiction, but I grew up reading and watching movies, in fact, where Aboriginal people weren't there in the future. You know, we were genocided, we were extinct, we were mysteriously vanished. And I know that that's not going to happen. So it made me think about why this is the case. One of the biggest reasons is that there weren't a lot of Aboriginal people writing our stories that are set in the future. Or at least publishing them. And I wanted to try my own hand at it, so I decided I would write a book of speculative fiction that imagined my community, which is the Tweedgeri community on Bundjalung country. And I wanted to imagine people in my community living in various futures. So the book's a short story collection. It's not a novel. And each of the stories are set in the future in the Tweed. But they're all set in different versions of the future. So I wanted to think about different climate scenarios. I wanted to think about different political situations that might arise. So some of the stories are set like very close to now, but some are a lot further into the future. I think of them as little thought experiments. So I'm asking, you know, what would happen if the world were frozen or if the oceans rose? How would my community live? And each of the stories not only thinks about the future, but how my community would assert or reassert their sovereignty in these worlds. I think I came up with a pretty diverse collection of futures and characters, and it was very fun to write. It was also very sad to write sometimes because I was grappling with a lot of my fears, but also my hopes for the future too, you know.
Yeah. Now, the book seems to emphasize the importance of connection to country and culture. How did your personal connection to the Tweed homeland influence the settings and cultural elements in the stories?
Well, I grew up in the Tweed, and I've never known any other, you know, community to call my own. I don't have a Bundjalung bloodline. I mentioned earlier we have a pretty long history of removals and things like that in my family. But there's also been other kinds of adoptions in my family too. So through my Bundjalung and South Sea Islander stepdad, I became part of that community from a young age, and I've always been very involved in my community. And it's just where I call home. Even, you know, moving away a lot, moving back, moving away, I've always just found that to be my home. And I don't think I could have written this book or set it in any other place because I don't know anywhere as well. You know, that's my home. Doesn't matter where I live. So my connections there are through family, but also through my involvement in education, in sports, disability, the arts, all kinds of things over a lifetime. And so as a kind of, I don't know, maybe a present or a love letter to people in my community who helped grow me up and who I've also helped grow up. I wanted to center us in these stories. I wanted to show examples of thriving characters who are grounded in country and community, you know, living the way that we always have and always will. And that is, you know, with each other, you know, loving, fighting, fishing, surfing, all the things, but, you know, in different kinds of futures.
Yeah. Now, the reviewer mentions that some of your writing seems to channel a higher intelligence. How do you approach writing scenes that deal with a spiritual or metaphysical concept?
Yeah, well, I am a spiritual person, and I think that comes from my upbringing and our grounding in cultural ways here. I do feel very connected to, you know, my own ancestors, but also ancestors from this place because of the relationships that I have with people and with culture and all that stuff, and just a lot of the intellectual and emotional work of belonging to a community and to a place that happens, you know, over a lifetime. I don't know that I'm channeling a higher thing. You know, it's not so much that I'm living in, you know, quote unquote, the real world and then kind of tap into the spiritual world. To me, they're one and the same. They intermingle, they flow in and out of each other. I don't see them as separate. Other people might. But to me, you know, the spiritual and the energy of life is in everything. It's not separate. It doesn't live in heaven. It doesn't live in another place, but it lives in country and it lives all around me. I breathe it. I swim in it. I speak it. I listen to it. You know, I'm held by it, all of that kind of stuff. And that really comes from the way I was brought up in a cultural sense.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on how you incorporated themes of environmental restoration and sustainability into a decolonized future?
Part of these thought experiments were, you know, if we were living in, let's say an example being a world of global warming where the weather's really wild and it's cycling rapidly, I wanted to think about how not only my community and my family, of course, would live in this world, but how they would actively be caring for country. Now, we know that, you know, we have all these really intelligent and wonderful technologies, such as, you know, fire stick farming and other traditional ecological practices that have been really regenerative and allowed us to live really sustainably on this continent for, you know, however long, a very long time, far longer than anyone on Earth. And I wanted to think about how these kind of technologies might help people live in the future as well. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, localized fire stick farming is going to solve global warming. It isn't. But it will provide a localized buffer and a localized solution to the effects. So unfortunately, I don't think that, you know, a small group of ragtag gurus in the future will change the world in that respect. But I do have a hope that lots of groups like this working in tandem and working the world over will be able to do something. But yeah, to me, it's really important to show these ancestrally approved ways of living with country and not living beyond our means and not living as though we have, you know, infinite resources, because we don't, but living within our means and living with respect, in harmony, in symbiosis, not as parasites, which is what colonial capitalism has brought to this continent and why our lands and our waters are so ravaged.
And now the book is also described as a call to national awakening. What specific changes or realizations do you hope readers will take away from your stories?
Look, I don't really know, because I feel a little bit out of touch with, I guess, the average reader. I wrote this book first and foremost for my community, for people in my community, in my family, people who would like to see ourselves in the future. And of course, other people, anyone else can read it. They're very welcome to. But I wasn't thinking of them when I was writing it. I was specifically thinking about my community. And that's why there's certain language and ways of talking and ways of thinking in there. I was centering the people in my community and not other people. So I find it a hard question to think about. I don't really know what I want people to take away from it. I hope they enjoy my stories, of course. Like, I'm a storyteller. That's my number one goal, is for people to enjoy my stories. But I don't really want to prescribe a reaction. You know, everybody's going to come to these stories with their own their histories, their own worldviews, and that's going to mix on the page with whatever I've written, and they will take what they want from that. But yeah, as long as they enjoy it, you know, the rest is up to them.
We've only got a few minutes left before we wrap up. Anything you'd like to add to the conversation?
I want to go back to talking about the title of the book that you mentioned, and I want to, you know, pay respect to where the slogan "Always Was, Always Will Be Aboriginal Land" comes from. So this originated in the 1980s through the grassroots Aboriginal land rights movement in far western New South Wales. And now the phrase has been attributed to Barkindji land rights activist William Bates's father, or Badger Bates's father, Uncle Jim Bates. They were out on country around this time, and Jim, the elder, he became really excited and he started telling stories about his country and his land. And his son said, "Dad, it's not your land anymore. White fellas own it." And his dad said, "No, they only borrowed it. It always was, always will be Aboriginal land." And from there, that phrase kind of really caught on, and it spread like wildfire throughout the movement. And I wanted to use, I used half of it, as you said, I used the last half of it, because these stories are set in the future, and I wanted to, like, capture the futurist part of that wonderful phrase, and to assert sovereignty through my stories, to say that, yes, we always will be here. Yes, we always were here, we know that, but we always will be, because so many Australian stories have tried to erase us from the future. And in fact, if we want to connect this to what we were talking about earlier with the stolen generations, policies tried to erase us from the future too, you know, and we're living proof that that didn't work. And so I'm hoping this book and these stories will, you know, be a really powerful way of speaking back to that.
Yeah, now that you explained it, actually, I see in this phrase an element of resilience and rebellion as well. Not just rebellion, but yes, resilience, because it's, no, it's not taken. It always has been and always will be. So it really puts it in context and in how it should be understood, not only by First Nations, but everyone else around the country. Nobody knows the depth of this phrase.
That's right. And I think it's really important when we're you know, whether we're academics or not, but when there's a phrase that is so ubiquitous and people know it, to pay respect to where it came from, because that's, you know, yeah, that's just a big part of my ethics as an Aboriginal person, to always honour the people who kind of pass their knowledge on to me.
Yeah. Michaela Saunders, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on ITV Radio today.
Beautiful. Thanks so much. Happy NAIDOC Week.
Thanks, and happy NAIDOC Week to you too.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.